Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science. The lead story, once again, concerns the coronavirus, both the bad news, of which there's plenty, as well as a silver lining, believe it or not. First of all, we have the bad news. Europe is undergoing a second devastating lockdown. England, Germany, France, many European countries have either instituted a second lockdown or are thinking about it, given the fact that coronavirus infection rates are rising across Europe. So you may say to yourself, well, where is the good news in all of this? Well, one piece of good news is that even though the infection rate is rising, the death rate, people who actually die of the coronavirus, that number has pretty much held steady, rising slightly, but it's not like what's happening with the infection rate. So how's that possible? And also, for the first time, scientists now have hard numbers concerning whether or not you should wear a mask, practice social distancing, go to church, sing in a church choir. We are now getting hard numbers, which are quite startling. For example, did you know that you're 16 times more likely to get the virus if you regularly go to church, participate, let's say, in a summer camp or large dinners? 16 times more likely to come down with the virus. Hard numbers are now coming in. And also some oddball studies about the virus. Nasal spray. Did you know that scientists at Columbia and Cornell are investigating whether or not a nasal spray can protect you against the coronavirus? This is bizarre, but it's been proven true, at least in animals. And speaking of animals, we reported earlier that in Finland, at Helsinki Airport, dogs can detect the presence of the coronavirus in 10 seconds, not 2 days. 10 seconds, dogs can detect the presence of somebody who's infected with the virus with 96% accuracy. Now, of course, we can't duplicate that yet using machines, but one day, perhaps we'll have artificial intelligence machines that are as good as dogs in terms of isolating those people with the virus to 96% accuracy in just 10 seconds. And also, we have another mystery that's gradually being cleared up. Why is it that some people are immune to the virus? That's right, they are asymptomatic. In fact, 40 to 50% of people that have been infected are actually asymptomatic. In fact, a neighbor of mine, well, the husband was near death, in fact, with a very bad case of the virus. He was given dexamethasone, which he claimed saved him, but his wife didn't have any symptoms whatsoever of the virus. And so then the question, why is that? Now scientists are beginning to get some hard numbers in terms of what could protect the average person and perhaps give us an early warning system as who will go to the ICU and who will simply walk away. And then news not from inner space but outer space. There's a new study coming out by astronomers giving the most accurate number now for the number of planets there are in the Milky Way galaxy that are compatible with life. In the last 2 years, since the Kepler satellite was crippled, scientists have had a chance to crunch through the numbers, and you might be surprised to find out how many Earth-like planets there are in our backyard in the Milky Way galaxy. Okay, well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The lead story, once again, is that the coronavirus infection rate is peaking, in fact, worse than before. Some people say this is the third wave of the virus hitting Europe especially hard. Lockdowns, of course, do tremendous damage to the economy, to people's livelihood, everything. However, England, Germany, France, and other countries have either instituted a lockdown or are seriously contemplating it, even though it's going to create a backlash, even though it's going to devastate their already ruined economy, even though it's going to increase human suffering. And, well, some people are saying that the reason why is because people are suffering from coronavirus fatigue. They're tired of a lockdown. They're tired of all this deprivation and loss of income. Maybe that's the reason. But there's a silver lining to this, which is quite remarkable. First of all, if you look at the infection rate, it, of course, is soaring. However, if you look at take a look at the death rate, that is, the number of people who actually die, you find out the death rate is pretty much stable, rising slightly, but pretty much stable. So how is that possible that the infection rate could soar, but the death rate is relatively stable, more or less? Well, there's several theories. One theory is that the infection rate measures young people. Young people are more immune to the virus than older individuals, and it's young people that are coming down with the virus. But there are other theories as well as to what's causing this behavior. First of all, compared to March, if you look at the hospitalization rate in New York City compared to March, the death rate has gone down by a factor of 3. That's an incredible drop. Now, of course, people say that the death rate, no matter what it is too high, but it's gone down by a factor of 3 from March. Why is that? Well, if you interview the doctors there, they're pretty clear. We have better therapies, better ways of handling these patients. While back in March, people were clueless. Doctors were overwhelmed. They didn't know what to do. No cure in sight. No therapeutic seemed to work. There was only superstition, hearsay, and rumors to go by. Now, doctors have remdesivir, which has been proven to reduce the number of days in the ICU at a hospital. We have dexamethasone, which helps with the cytokine storm, which is actually what kills people. The virus itself does not kill you. It's the body's overreaction to the virus, which actually kills you. And also tricks that they've learned to control breathing for these patients. For example, if you turn the patient over, you can free up the lungs, and so these people don't necessarily die because they can't gasp for air. A simple maneuver like turning the body can actually save your life. Not to mention that doctors are much more careful about oxygen levels. There's something called a dosimeter, which could save your life. A dosimeter is a small contraption, only costs about $50. I got one off the internet myself. And it measures how much oxygen there is in your blood with a very simple meter, doesn't prick your skin at all. And it tells you, it's an early warning system that tells you that you are struggling breathing, that you are much worse than you think you are. Even though you think you can gut it out, you can't gut it out, you're near death. The dosimeter tells you that. In fact, with President Donald Trump, it was the dosimeter that alerted his doctors to the fact that even though he felt miserable, but he thought he could gut it through, the doctor says, nope, in you go. Same thing with the average person. So death rates are going down. And again, the death rate for the general population for the coronavirus is about 1%. That means most of the time, on average, 99% of those people infected could simply walk away after several weeks. But you see, that death rate is an average over the entire population. Now, older people are savvy now to the virus. Young people think they live forever, but young people are more immune to the virus than old people. That could also explain why the infection rate keeps on rising, but the death rate rises very slowly, specifically because we have better therapeutics, better ways of handling people in the ICU, plus the fact that if you're young, the probability of dying is not just 1%, it's much less than 1% because of the fact that the 1% death rate was an average over the entire population. Now, another piece of good news, even though we know that you should wear a mask and practice social distancing, how effective are they anyway? People get into fistfights over this question. Now, we're beginning to get some hard numbers. It turns out that if you take a look at people who go to church, let's say twice a week for a period of time, people who go to summer camps, have many, many family get-togethers and parties. They are, get this, 16 times more likely to test positive on the coronavirus. Why is that? For example, at a church, you're packed in like sardines, plus the church choir sings, singing in loud voices and coughing, that spreads the virus. And you're there not just for a few minutes, no, you're there for a few hours. And so the combination of all that means you are 16 times more likely if you engage in these intense social communal activities. Well, what about public transportation? Should you take the bus? Should you take the subway? Well, we now have numbers. You are four times more likely to come down with the virus if you take public transportation. Now, the report that I have did not differentiate between the subway and the bus. But think about it for a moment. If you're in a bus or a subway, and people can cough and sneeze hours before you're in that bus with very little circulation, you're breathing infected air. If you take a taxi, however, realize that that's not the ideal solution either. However, you're separated from the driver with a plastic shield normally. Plus, you can open the windows, let cool air circulate inside the taxi cab. And so there are ways to lower the infection rate that you get by going into a taxi, which you can't do by going into a bus or going into the subway system. Now, we should also point out that there is the greatest mystery of all concerning the coronavirus. And why is it that some people are immune? Some people, as I mentioned, simply walk away. They're asymptomatic. 40 to 50% of those people that are exposed to the virus have no symptoms whatsoever. And why is it that certain people in the ICU, some people just drop and die immediately. Other people just gut it out for weeks and weeks and eventually survive. Why is it? Well, scientists are now zeroing in on the immune system. And they realize that there's something called an autoantibody. An autoantibody is an antibody that the body uses to protect itself, but it attacks the body rather than the intended target. Autoantibodies. And if you simply measure the level of autoantibodies in the blood of somebody who's on the ICU near death versus somebody who has a very mild exposure to the virus, you can see it in the numbers. And so scientists are beginning to realize that it's the variation in your immune system that's responsible for the variation in your responses. So, for example, somebody who is relatively immune to the disease, either A, has a very strong immune system, or B, was previously exposed to the coronavirus in terms of a cold. Because several varieties of the common cold are in fact caused by a cousin of the coronavirus. And so that may explain in part why some people are totally asymptomatic. Now, why can this be of use if you are exposed to the virus? Because doctors, when they get a patient, they don't know how dangerous it is for the patient. They don't know who's most susceptible. There's no metric by which they can guess. It's simply putting a number out of a hat, using intuition to try to figure out how vulnerable certain people are. This gives you a metric. It gives you a way of measuring how vulnerable people are by looking at the autoantibodies that a person has. And from that, you can then begin to prepare. You can then begin to prepare a strategy for that person. So in other words, we now believe that it may be possible, not using hocus pocus, but using sound science to begin to, when you first see a patient, begin to create a regimen to treat that person, whether that person is going to be suffering from a very severe case of the virus or no virus whatsoever. So in other words, we still have no cure other than a vaccine, but we have ways in which to attack the virus. And that has reduced the death rate in New York City by a factor of 3 times. This is good news. And again, it's the death rate that is perhaps the most accurate indicator of how severe the virus is, not the infection rate. The infection rate depends a lot on the health of the person, plus whether the person is a young person or an old person. And now that young people are getting the virus, it means that not just 1% of them will die, but a fraction of 1% will die, because that 1% figure averages over the entire population. Now, let's leave the world of inner space and go into the world of outer space for a minute. We know several years ago that the Kepler satellite, which was launched into orbit, gave us the identities of 4,000 exoplanets circulating other stars in the Milky Way galaxy. And unfortunately, it was in 2018 that the Kepler satellite became a crippled satellite. Now we have a replacement for the Kepler in orbit called TESS. Now we have a mountain, an encyclopedia of data. Now, for the first time, scientists have sifted through this mountain of data to give us the key question. And that is, how many twins of the Earth are there in outer space? First of all, we need a metric. We need criteria. We need numbers by which we can judge that question. So they came up with three criteria for looking for twins of the Earth in outer space. First, the sun. You see, if the mother star is a red dwarf stars are very plentiful, but they're also unstable. They shoot out huge solar flares into the vacuum of space, meaning that any planet that goes around a red dwarf star would be bathed in high-energy radiation, making life very difficult to get off the ground. So even though red dwarf stars are nice, even though some of them may actually have planets which are suitable for life, in the main, they are unstable and perhaps not very hospitable to complex life forms. So the first criterion is the star should be sun-like, meaning a yellow star, hydrogen-burning yellow star, that is relatively stable. And our sun is relatively stable. So that's the first criteria. The second criteria is the size. We don't want them to be Jupiter-sized, because Jupiter-sized planets have huge, gigantic, thick atmospheres. And Jupiter, in turn, also has a huge radiation belt surrounding it, which would fry any planet or moon that goes around Jupiter. So you don't want to have a planet that is too big, or for that matter, too small. You want a planet that has the right size. And third, you want to have the planet with oceans. Now, of course, it's very difficult to detect oceans from this distance. So what we do is we try to find whether or not the planet is in the Goldilocks zone. The Goldilocks zone is a planet that's not too close, where the oceans would boil, or not too far, where the oceans would freeze, from the mother star. In other words, you want to have temperate climates with liquid water oceans on them to get life off the ground. And we should also point out that there's some exceptions to these three criteria, but they have to be looked at. If you take a look at Jupiter, one of the moons of Jupiter is called Europa. It has an ocean of liquid water, which is actually bigger in volume than the oceans of the planet Earth. And it's just a moon. It's because our oceans are paper thin. Our oceans are maybe 5 miles deep, while the oceans of Europa, a moon of Jupiter, is much deeper, and liquid water can exist. Liquid water, in turn, is the amniotic fluid of life itself. And so anyway, these scientists got together and said, let's do the count. Now that we have this encyclopedia of planets, let's see which ones are suitable. First of all, they found out that on average, every star in the Milky Way galaxy has a planet or two going around it. On average, every star has a planet going around it. That's amazing. So tonight, when you look at the night sky, you really have to wonder whether somebody is looking back at you from outer space. Then the next question is, if you eliminate the Jupiter-sized planets, what about the Earth-sized planets? It turns out that we have something called super-Earths. planets that are rocky, like the Earth, but maybe, let's say, 2 to 3 to 4 times bigger than the Earth. Well, that's cutting it kind of close, because you remember that the gravity of the Earth is very suitable for the creation of life, and if the planet is too big, then perhaps it's no longer hospitable to the creation of complex life forms. Then if you ask yourself, how many of these planets are exactly Earth-like and have liquid water oceans, in other words, a twin of the Earth in outer space, the answer turns out to be, well, zero. We don't know of any planet that's exactly like the Earth. And in fact, we find that almost all the solar systems that we've analyzed, none of them, I repeat, none of them are like our solar system. We are the oddball. Now, when I was in elementary school, I still remember getting my first book on astronomy, my very first book when I was a child. And the book said our solar system is probably pretty average, pretty ordinary. You have rocky planets going around the sun in the middle. Then you have outside gas giants going around the sun in circular orbits. So nothing special about our solar system. We're pretty much average. Boy, were we wrong. We realized that of the 4,000 planets that we've analyzed, none of them, not a single one of them, is like our solar system. First of all, the orbits. The orbits of many of these planets are not perfect circles at all. You want perfect circles because they're stable. You don't want planets to blow apart or collide. But many of these solar systems have wandering planets, planets in irregular orbits or oddball orbits. So we know that's an indication that we've been brainwashed into thinking that our solar system is normal, when in fact it is abnormal. Then we also thought that our solar system was normal because planets go in a circle, and that's the way it's always been. Wrong. In these other planets, we have Jupiter-sized planets very close to the mother star, as close as Mercury. In other words, we have wandering Jupiters. Now think about that for a moment. If Jupiter is formed very far away from the sun, and it starts to crawl its way toward the center of the solar system, it's going to fling Mars, it's going to fling the Earth into outer space. And maybe that's what happens. These are called rogue planets. And NASA actually found an Earth-sized rogue planet just last week. These rogue planets do not rotate around a star at all. They're simply wandering in outer space. Why? Because they probably got too close to a Jupiter-sized planet. Jupiter then flung it into outer space. And as a consequence, they are rogue dark planets. If one of them catches up to us, sneaks up to us, we'd be clueless. Clueless because they're dark. They give off no light whatsoever. So anyway, what is the conclusion? The conclusion of the study was that our Milky Way galaxy has, out of 100 billion stars, 4 billion. 4 billion are sun-like. How many of them are exactly like the Earth? Well, so far, zero. But how many of them are in the ballpark of being close to Earth, sufficient to have life on them? The answer is minimum 300 million. So just to repeat, on average now, there are at minimum 300 million Earth-like planets, not twins, but very close to being twins of the Earth, orbiting the Milky Way galaxy. And that's a minimum. More than likely, said the report, there are several billion planets that could harbor life on them. So that's an amazing statement. And then, of course, the statement that everyone asks is, why don't they visit us? I mean, after all, if the galaxy is teeming with these life forms, if that's a conclusion analyzing years of data coming from the Kepler satellite, then the logical question is, where are they? Well, the short answer is, we don't know. But I have my own particular point of view, and that is, if they can reach the Earth from outer space, in fact, this report says that the closest planet that looks like the Earth is 20 light years from the planet Earth, then their technology would be much more advanced than our technology. Perhaps they would be thousands of years more advanced to have starships that can travel light years across the Milky Way galaxy. Now, if they're that advanced, then the next question is, why should they bother to come to the Earth? We think we're so special that they're going to come trillions of miles, many light years, just to land on the White House lawn to give us the benefit of their technology. I mean, I don't think so. Because after all, if we go to the forest and we see forest animals, do we go down to the squirrels and the deer and try to talk to them? Well, I think maybe initially we might, but eventually we'll get bored because the deer and the squirrels, they don't talk back to us. In fact, they don't even want to talk to us. And so the question is, if they come to the Earth, we're like squirrels to them. We're like the deer, kind of interesting to look at, kind of cute, but after a while, you're kind of bored because we have nothing to offer them. Now, you may say to yourself, well, look at all the cultural treasures that we have, works of Shakespeare and Hemingway and stuff like that. But realize that Hemingway and Shakespeare may mean nothing, nothing at all to an alien civilization that has a different language, different culture, different ethics, totally different way of looking at the universe. And in fact, they may even be dangerous. For example, if you're a deer in the forest, who is most dangerous to you? The hunter with a gigantic shotgun that can kill you instantly? Or is the danger a mild-mannered lawyer with a briefcase who happens to work for a construction company that wants to pave your forest? So at first you may say that the hunter is more dangerous because he has a rifle, but then think about it. The developer may just want to pave over the entire forest, and he doesn't necessarily hate the animals. He's not cruel in his own mind. It's just that the animals get in the way. So that's one more thing to worry about. The fact that even though these aliens from outer space may be so advanced that they leave us alone, or we might just get in the way, in which case it's doomsday for us. So who knows for sure? But let me make one prediction. I think sometime in this century, we'll probably make contact with another civilization in outer space. Well, that concludes the first part of exploration. In the second part of exploration, we're going to focus in on the environment, specifically energy. Is there a new form of energy that can solve the energy crisis and hence the greenhouse effect? Some people think it could be fusion. But what is fusion anyway? And what are the pitfalls and promises of fusion nuclear power plant into this century? Stay tuned for the second half of Exploration. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. Well, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about something that was not mentioned prominently in the recent presidential debates, and that's the question of the greenhouse effect, and what are we going to do about energy? But one thing that wasn't mentioned at all between the presidential candidates was a dark horse called fusion power. Now, I'm a physicist. We physicists hope dearly that one day the power of the sun, fusion power, will power the machines here on the planet Earth without having to worry about meltdowns, without having to worry about the catastrophes associated with nuclear waste and accidents that bedevil fission nuclear power plants based on uranium. You see, hydrogen burns cleanly. Its waste product is helium gas, which is actually commercially valuable. And the source of fuel for a fusion reactor is seawater. The hydrogen in seawater can be extracted and fused to give you almost unlimited power. So what's the catch? It's so great that you think that politicians will be flocking to promote fusion reactors. Well, the problem is they're not here yet. Technology is not yet mature to be able to squeeze gas to tens of millions of degrees in order to create a miniature sun on the planet Earth. Well, with us today to talk about the pros and cons of fusion power is Professor Charles Seif of NYU, author of a book, Fusion in a Bottle. And so the question is fusion a dark horse? Is it a viable technology? Or is it always 20 years in the distance? We'll try to bring some answers with Professor Seif as we talk about fusion in a bottle.
Professor Seif, you're a journalist. However, you've written about cosmology, and now you've written a new book called Sun in a Bottle, The Strange History of Fusion and the Science of Wishful Thinking. So how did you, as a journalist, get interested in things that most journalists avoid like the plague?
Well, I have to say I'm really a physics geek at heart. Back before I became a journalist, I studied physics and mathematics, and it was only fairly late in my education that I decided that I was more suited to writing than I was to actually performing scientific work. Mm-hmm. So even at the very beginning of my career, I was interested in writing about physics because that's what I loved. And so my career has been covering physics for a decade and change. And from the very beginning of the time that I was writing, among my first pieces was a large piece about fusion. And coming from the physics point of view, I thought of this wonderful thing which would solve the world's energy crises. And as a journalist approaching it, I saw that it was a little bit more complex than I had initially expected with my physics goggles on.
Okay, well, let's just jump right into your book. Your book starts out at some of the hairiest days of the Cold War. In 1945, the United States drops a fission bomb on Hiroshima and another fission bomb on Nagasaki based on uranium and plutonium. But then in the 1950s, a new race emerges, not with uranium and plutonium, but with the hydrogen bomb. So explain to us, what is the difference between the fission bombs that were dropped on Japan and the hydrogen bomb based on fusion?
Well, fission and fusion are two sides of the same coin. In some sense, every atom wants to be iron. It has iron envy. So things which are heavier than iron, like uranium and plutonium, want to split apart in the same sense that a ball wants to roll down a hill. And in the process of splitting apart, they release energy. Fusion, on the other hand, takes light elements. Light elements, in some sense, want to stick together and get heavier, getting closer to iron. It turns out that the fusion end of the reaction is more energetic per atom than fission. That is, breaking apart atoms gives you a lot of energy, but fusion, sticking them together, gives you a lot more. So at the end of the Manhattan Project, when the project ended, the United States had a bomb that used fission to power it. In its simplest form, basically all it did was take two hunks of uranium, stick them together, and wham, you get an explosion. So it was easy to do once you got the uranium material to set off the reaction. Edward Teller, a physicist at the Manhattan Project, was very strongly in favor of using the other side of the coin, fusion, because he realized that it would lead to a weapon of unlimited power, and he called it the super. And the idea basically was to use an explosion, a nuclear, a fission explosion, to set off a fusion explosion, which was much, much, much greater. And Teller was right. The weapon that he eventually created was vastly more powerful than even what obliterated Hiroshima and Nagasaki. To give you a sense of scale, Hiroshima was about a 14-kiloton explosion, the equivalent of 14,000 tons of TNT exploding in the same place at the same time. The first full fusion test, called Ivy Mike, was 10 megatons, 10 million tons, almost 1,000 times larger than Hiroshima. It evaporated the island it was on, and that was just the beginning. In theory, you can make a fusion bomb as large as you want. The biggest ever detonated was the Russian Tsar Bomba, which was more than 50 megatons of TNT. And after a certain point, it's pointless to get larger because you just wind up lifting a larger and larger column of atmosphere into space, so it doesn't do that much more damage. So even though it promised unlimited power, unless you wanted to destroy the Earth, it wasn't that much more effective at doing damage than a fission bomb. But at the same time, the Cold War was getting hot. The Russians had detonated their first nuclear weapon way before Americans thought they could get it, thanks in part to a spy operation that penetrated Los Alamos. So a panicked America realized, we have to get ahead of the Russians and keep nuclear supremacy. So they turned to Edward Teller's idea of a super bomb as a way of staying ahead of the Russian nuclear weapon industry. And as we know, the Russians caught up very, very quickly, and it turned into a nuclear stalemate where each side had so many weapons in their arsenal that they could destroy the world many times over.
And I should also point out that when I was in high school, Edward Teller was actually my advisor, and he actually sort of guided my career in the early years when I was at Harvard. However, moving on now, we have the Cold War in full swing, and people are now used to the idea that there is a bomb 1,000 times more powerful than the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bomb. But other people have said, well, look at Mother Nature. Mother Nature uses fusion to light up the heavens. So now explain to us how Mother Nature uses the process of fusion, not fission, to light up the universe.
Yes, it's fusion is responsible for all life on Earth. The sun is essentially a big ball of hydrogen. It's hydrogen gas, and when it was coalescing, it was compressing itself under its own gravity, and collapsing, compressing objects get hot in general, and so you've got this ball of hydrogen that got hot and dense, hotter and denser, and eventually it got so hot and so dense that the hydrogen, moving extremely fast because of the energy of the temperature, the high temperatures involved, started slamming into each other with enough force to cause fusion reactions. So once you get a big ball of gas large enough to collapse under its own gravity and heat everything up high enough, you get a fusion reaction. And the fusion reaction is what makes the sun shine. These hydrogens getting converted eventually into helium release energy, and that energy shines out in all directions. That's what makes stars shine. But this reaction is extraordinarily difficult to get going. You need such an enormous ball of hydrogen to kickstart that fusion reaction that it's hard to do. Even a mass of hydrogen the size of Jupiter is almost like a star. The problem is it's not large enough to get so hot that you start that fusion reaction in its belly. So Jupiter is, in essence, everything that a star has except just that extra gravitational oomph to get it hot enough and tight enough to ignite.
And in fact, in the movie 2010, Arthur C. Clarke talks about aliens igniting Jupiter, so our solar system becomes a double star system. However, Jupiter would have to be about 10 times bigger at minimum, in order to get ignition. Now, let's talk about the promise of fusion. Why has fusion hypnotized whole generations of inventors and quacks and top physicists? What is the promise of fusion? Why is there so much interest in it? Why have so many charlatans jumped into the game?
Imagine if you had a sun on your desktop, that in a little bottle you had a fusion reaction going. If you could get this, if you could have something like this, you basically have an unlimited source of energy. Hydrogen is abundant. It's the most abundant element in the universe. It's everywhere. It's in the oceans. Water is two atoms of hydrogen for one atom of oxygen. So if you were able to tap into the sun's reaction and turn hydrogen into helium and releasing energy in the process, you can turn this virtually unlimited source of fuel into energy for free. And because the fusion reaction, if you manage to get it working in the right way, you could just keep feeding hydrogen in, and helium and energy come out. And helium is clean. I mean, if you wanted to, you could release it into the atmosphere and it would float up into space. And so this promises, in theory, unlimited energy with unlimited fuel and no waste. Reality is not quite as simple as that, but that is the promise.
Okay, and for Spider-Man fans, for those people who saw Spider-Man 2, Dr. Octopus creates fusion in his laboratory in Manhattan, which is not the place to do it. But the machine looks like a little sun. It looks like actually a star. And you can see sunspots and solar flares on this miniature sun. However, in real life, we don't expect to create a miniature sun like in Spider-Man 2. What will a fusion reactor really look like?
Well, there's two main areas that mainstream fusion researchers are looking at to make a real fusion reactor, and they are lasers and magnets. Lasers are a very clever way of getting the heat and pressure that you need to take a hydrogen pellet and make it collapse and start fusing. Basically, you shine laser light from all directions, and you squash a tiny pellet, and as it squashes, it compresses, and hopefully it ignites. And if you manage to get lasers that are strong and efficient enough that you create more energy out of that collapsing, fusing, tiny pellet of hydrogen than you consume by getting the lasers going in the first place, then you've got a source of energy. You've got a fusion reactor. No one has gotten that far, but it is theoretically possible. Another method is using magnets. It turns out that magnetic fields affect fusing plasmas like hydrogen. And if you shape a magnetic field right, you can create a bottle with which to contain a very hot cloud of hydrogen. And so a magnetic donut shaped right and with a cloud of hydrogen you throw heat in, eventually you might get a fusing plasma. And once you get that reaction going, you just have to figure out a way of piping new hydrogen in and piping fused helium out, and you've got a source of energy going. Again, these magnetic bottles aren't working to the point where you get more energy out than you put in heating the plasma and containing it. But in theory, if our magnets improve and our knowledge improves over time, you might have a magnetic bottle that contains a miniature sun.
Okay, now, because a fusion machine would use ordinary seawater, which is limitless pretty much, as the basic energy source, and because the energy released is almost limitless, the number of charlatans and quacks that have gone into the business is quite large. So let's talk about some of the false starts and some of the dashed hopes. Beginning with a Dr. Richter, but the list is long, let's talk about some of the false starts.
Yes, the goal is so lofty, that the unlimited energy, that the idea of fusion has attracted quacks and hoaxers and genuine scientists who are misguided from the very beginning. In 1951, the world was absolutely stunned to headlines that Argentina, of all places, had solved our energy problems forever. There was a German expat named Ronald Richter who had convinced Juan Perón to fund a research laboratory on a secret island in the middle of a lake to get fusion reactions going in what he called a solar thermotron. And he kept the world going for about a year. People were arguing back and forth, could he have done it, could he not have done it? It turns out Richter was barking mad. He would get this wild look in his eyes and dump a whole bunch of gunpowder into his experiment and blow the doors off of his laboratory in gigantic explosions and rush out and write fusion on a piece of ticker tape. And yet, for many months, he kept Juan Perón's government believing that he was on his way to solving the world's energy crises, and this would be a great prestige for Argentina. Eventually, physicists in Argentina convinced Perón that something was going on that was a little fishy. They went and visited the laboratory with their own Geiger counters, and if, in fact, you have fusion reactions going, you should be able to detect neutron radiation coming off, and they detected nothing. So they proved that Ronald Richter was perpetrating a fraud, and contemporary accounts say that he wasted between $4 million and $70 million of the Argentinian treasury in the process of pursuing his dream. And he disappeared off the world stage very rapidly, as you can imagine. But, in fact, everyone who is involved in fusion in some form winds up deceiving themselves or deceiving others about their achievements. In 1958, British scientists at a very, very prestigious lab built this machine called Zeta. Zeta was a magnetic bottle of sorts, and the scientists had convinced themselves that they had gotten fusion in a laboratory. And they cracked open beers, they announced to the world that they were on their way to solving the world's energy crises. Turns out that they were wrong, that they were not seeing fusion, that they were deceiving themselves with neutrons. They were seeing neutrons, but it wasn't from fusion that they wanted. So they had to humiliate themselves on the world stage. After all these tabloids said energy to last a lifetime, no more energy bills, the British teams had to say, well, not really.
Okay, now more recently, we had this huge fiasco concerning two chemists, Pons and Fleischmann, who grabbed world attention, covers of, I think, Newsweek magazine and the New York Times, and everyone was talking about, well, did Pons and Fleischmann create fusion in a bottle? Not hot fusion, the hot fusion of lasers and magnets, but cold fusion. So tell us a little bit about cold fusion.
Yes. In 1989, two chemists, one of whom was extremely well celebrated, made this announcement to the press that absolutely stunned the world. They claimed that where these hot fusion, this magnetic fusion, this laser fusion research has been failing for years, wasting tens of billions of dollars, these two chemists, working independently, had spent $100,000, and they had solved the problem. And what they argued was that they managed to pipe hydrogen into a chunk of metal, a palladium, which has the interesting property that soaks up hydrogen like a sponge. And the theory was that if you get enough hydrogen in there, the hydrogen will be forced so close together that they might be forced to fuse. And in doing the research on their own, they thought they saw more energy coming out of their palladium cell than was going in. So they thought they had created a device which was creating fusion energy. So as you can imagine, as soon as this was announced, it was headlines everywhere. Cover of Time, cover of Newsweek, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, everywhere was talking about this for months and months and months. It turned out that the scientists were deceiving themselves. There was a bit of fishiness. Some data was moving back and forth. It's uncertain exactly what was going on, but when the cells were reproduced in better circumstances with more sophisticated equipment, it turned out that there was no excess energy, and more importantly, there were no neutrons coming out. It turns out when you fuse heavy forms of hydrogen together, you expect neutrons to fly away, and neutrons are a sign of fusion. They were seeing no neutrons, and that made it pretty clear that nothing was actually happening. However, it took it was a huge battle for years. Physicists versus chemists became a red state versus blue state thing, where the liberal elite physicists on the East Coast were trying to tear down research from chemists at the University of Utah. So it became a huge political battle that still affects the physics community on some level.
Now, you can simply calculate, using the back of an envelope, the neutron count that would occur if they really had fusion in a bottle, and it's sufficient to kill them. So the very fact that Pons and Fleischmann are still alive means that they could not possibly have attained fusion in a bottle. But then the question is, well, what did they attain? They did get net energy coming out. That's been verified by different laboratories. Some people have gone back to the literature on palladium back in the 1800s. It turns out that a person applied for a patent for one of the first cigarette lighters. He used palladium, put it in water, and attained a net amount of energy, which he used to light a flame. And he got a patent for it, a palladium cigarette lighter. And some people think that that's what they discovered. Well, what are your thoughts? It's been several years since then. What did Pons and Fleischmann really have in their bottle that gave energy? Was it a cigarette lighter or what?
It's really hard to tell. Palladium has an extraordinarily interesting chemistry. It has been fooling researchers for years, as you've noted, that not only is there that patent, a number in the early 20th century, two researchers thought they had achieved fusion in palladium. And because they were thinking along the same lines as Pons and Fleischmann were, and they thought they detected helium inside, an excess of helium inside palladium, which would be a nice sign of fusion because you're creating helium. It turns out that they were deceiving themselves because it turns out palladium soaks up helium just as well as it soaks up hydrogen, so you have enriched helium. So if they were seeing excess energy, and it's not entirely clear from the setup of the experiment that they were, I mean, they certainly thought they were. There was some sloppiness, but it's certainly possible that they were seeing it. It would most likely be a matter of chemistry, a chemical reaction where bonds are breaking, rather than a nuclear reaction where bonds in the center of a nucleus are being formed, that the nuclear bonds that change atoms into other atoms are what are changed in a fusion reaction, as opposed to the attachments between atoms, which are chemical bonds, which are being changed in a chemical reaction like burning paper or cracking water. And so whatever they were seeing almost certainly was a chemical reaction. And chemical reactions are well studied, and there's only so much you can do for solving the world's energy problems with chemical reactions. In fact, burning gasoline is an extraordinarily efficient chemical reaction that allows us to power our cars. So it's not certain that there's anything there for solving the world's energy problems unless you have a nuclear reaction of some sort. It's pretty clear that that is not what they saw.
Now, to a physicist, it was absolutely staggering that you had these two respected chemists that didn't understand anything about the quantum theory. If you bring the protons together very closely, as you mentioned, then you could attain fusion. But you have to bring them really close, 10 to the minus 13 centimeters. However, in the Pons and Fleischmann experiment, these atoms are separated by 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. And you can simply, using a back of an envelope calculation, this is what we give our undergraduates. Our undergraduates can calculate that the fusion you get in a bottle is almost zero as a consequence. So for the physics community, what was absolutely staggering is the fact that chemists don't know any physics at all. Well, let's move on, because we had a story, another apparently fraudulent story that just took place a few months ago, this time at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, involving something called bubble fusion. So explain to us, what is bubble fusion, and how did the Nazis, of all people, first stumble onto this whole thing called sonoluminescence?
Yes, sonoluminescence is this really bizarre reaction, and it's only very recently been understood. where basically you take sound waves and you bombard a liquid with it, and you induce what's called cavitation. Under the right circumstances, if you hit water very hard, it actually behaves like a solid, and it can crack. And just for a tiny, tiny fraction of a second, you can cause a crack in water. And what happens when you have that crack is you create a little vacuum, and that vacuum causes water to evaporate and causes a bubble. By bombarding liquids with sound waves, you cause these bubbles, and if you time those sound waves just right, you can cause those bubbles to collapse very dramatically. And it was discovered that if you do this just right, you get such a dramatic collapse that you get some sort of reaction. No one quite knows exactly what it is, even today, that causes a little flash of blue light. So if you turn off the lights and you bombard a tub of water with sound, you can actually get tiny little lights. And it's poorly understood, but it's really cool. You've got a mechanism for compressing and heating something, and a gentleman out at Oak Ridge named Rusi Taliarkhan came up with a clever idea of how to get enormous bubbles by shooting neutrons into the liquid that would collapse dramatically. And his hope was that by having this dramatic collapse and heating and compression, you might actually induce fusion in the center of the bubble.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, and if you want to find out more about my work, go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. I've written 4 New York Times bestsellers, and in Facebook, I have 4 million fans. And so once again, go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. Good day.